The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. If you're of a certain age, or have children of a certain age, or siblings of a certain age, or even if you were just alive in the 1990s, you probably had a moment recently. Yes, The Lion King is coming back, and the trailer for the remake became Disney's most watched trailer ever, and the second most watched trailer in history, behind only the trailer for The Last Avengers sequel. Remakes and sequels are not a new phenomenon, but in recent years it feels like they've taken over popular media inch by inch until there's not much room left for anything else. So how did that happen? What has been shifting in the entertainment industry over the past two decades? Why has the industry decided that serving the exact same meals over and over is the easiest way to feed us? And why do we gobble them up? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story.
My engagement with this stuff is always, oh, that's interesting, or yeah, I've seen that. There's like, it's a binary. There's no middle ground. There's no mildly successful remake. It either works or it doesn't. And it's because we know what it's supposed to look like.
Norm Willner is the senior film writer for Now Magazine. He's also the host of a great podcast called Somebody Else's Movie. So my first question is this just me? Is this just our team that sits around and is like, oh my God, they're remaking everything? Because it does seem that way, but you see all of the movies, so you tell me.
All of the movies and most of the television too. Yeah, it's not new, but it's more. It's definitely a more pronounced state of affairs that if there is something you fondly remember from 25 years ago and you thought, oh, I wonder, it has already been pitched as a remake. I mean, everything is coming back. Roseanne came back. Murphy Brown came back. I mean, all the stuff from the late 80s and early 90s that only really existed in the late 80s and early 90s is coming back now. Full House. There's a Captain Picard 30 years later series coming.
Oh, right. A Star Trek that's not a new Star Trek. It's the same character that everybody loves.
It's new old Star Trek. And I would say that there's a Simpsons reboot coming, but it's still going. So who can say?
If there wasn't, it would be coming.
By now, yeah, it would.
This is the phenomenon that I wanted to talk about because it's one thing. Remakes in the past have been like, this was a work of art that we are remaking this specific work of art, right?
Which generally, yeah.
You take one thing and you do it again, which is how we got A Star is Born.
Sure.
Fifth iteration.
Yeah. First one's not called A Star is Born, but yeah, there's five of them.
But reboots are something different, or remaking of an entire universe that has then the potential to do the entire thing again.
Just the idea that people are sort of seriously talking about who will play Harry Potter again.
Well, now. Somebody will, though, right?
But they shouldn't. I mean, that's the problem, right? The problem is that the impulse is not to wonder. It's again, I'm going to talk about, I'm going to reference a film because it's the only way my brain works, but it's Goldblum in Jurassic Park, which now has two new sequels. Before.
But your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Saying, you know, like, just because you can. It doesn't mean you should. You don't need to do these things. But we're so entrenched in a culture that only values recognition, that only values a property that already exists, that this is where we are. On my way here, out of the movie I saw this morning, which was an original film, although a biography, I passed posters for Dumbo and Mary Poppins Returns and Bumblebee, the Transformers prequel, I think. And I'm sure there was at least one other thing in there that has already been a thing and is going to be a thing again.
Well, the Grinch was right up there.
Yeah, this was a coming soon wall, so I'm trying to think of what else. But yeah, no, the Grinch is an excellent example. We don't need a new Grinch. The old one is beautiful, the original one with Karloff. And
we also had a Jim Carrey one.
We don't talk about that.
Okay.
That's actually...
If we have to not talk about some of these remakes, there's going to be a lot of films crossed off that list.
I was going to say that the Jim Carrey film is the best example for why you shouldn't do it in live action. So Universal, since they still own the property, said, well, okay, who can we get to animate it? And it was the guys who made the Despicable Me movies, I think. And it looks right because you can't screw up the Uncanny Valley thing with animation of a cartoon character. It's the only way to do that. But I guarantee you 15 years from now, there's going to be another live-action Grinch somehow. I don't know how or why, but that'll be the next turn because that's how it worked before. It was animation, live-action animation.
They'll do it as one of those stage plays that is broadcast live on
NBC
network
or
television.
Fox. Yeah, that's exactly right. There'll be a live Grinch.
There's so many ways things can exist now.
Oh, I'm sad now.
Okay, so you're the critic. How do you make a good remake? What elements make a remake not crappy?
I was going to say nobody knows. There is no tried and true formula. It used to be darker. Then it was sexier. Then it was sexier and darker. Then it was lighter and funnier and warm and nostalgic. And now it's whatever works, and nobody knows what works. I think you and I started talking about this on Twitter maybe last week because I was whining that the Lion King trailer had come out, and it's a photorealistic CG version of the beautiful hand-drawn animated original.
Yes.
And I said, there's no need for these things to exist.
How does this make you feel as a film critic?
My first instinct is to run outside with my Blu-ray of The Lion King and say, look, it's right here.
And you can watch it right now.
You can watch it right now. It is it's a beautiful film. It's based on Hamlet. You know, it's got educational value. It's got a Triumph of the Will sequence, which I'm still amazed that Disney allowed in a movie in 1994. But it's not going to get any better with real animals either.
But Beyonce's in it.
That's nice. You know, and that's the other thing, too. You can always get famous people to do these things because there's, you know, the performance is laid out for them. You're not being asked to do anything new. It's fun. Your kids or nieces or whoever are going to love watching you in it. But it's going to – I don't know. I haven't seen it. It doesn't – it's not finished, right? It's still being rendered somewhere.
Yes.
But I have seen it because it's The Lion King, because it is the same thing, because that's the weird mandate of these movies. With one or two exceptions, they're really just about slavishly recreating the thing you already like with live actors who are, by definition, less expressive and less interesting than the thing that was drawn. And in the case of The Lion King and Favreau's Jungle Book, they're not real either. Like, they're CG animals with the occasional human interaction. I have no idea how they're handling Lion King. There are no human characters, so I'm assuming everything is CG. But then why bother? What is there to it other than to pull people into a theater and get $20 for the IMAX version out of each one of them and show them a story they already know from beginning to end, which obviously is the point.
Up next,
whether they really want to see it or they're just kind of curious about it, that doesn't matter. As long as they click on it for Netflix, then Netflix has made it worth their while. And we're going to get more of it.
We all have investment goals, and Scotia iTrade can help you reach yours. Access free tools and resources to sharpen your investment skills. Visit ScotiaiTrade.com to start direct investing today. Scotia iTrade, there's a trader in all of us.
How did we get to the point where remakes and sequels and all sorts of iterations on existing franchises have become such an incredible percentage of all the entertainment created? Because I know that they've already existed, but this is 2017's top worldwide grosses at the box office. Star Wars, The Last Jedi, Beauty and the Beast, The Fate of the Furious, which is sequel number 7 or 8, Despicable Me 3, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, that is a sequel, Spider-Man Homecoming, which is either a sequel or a reboot.
It's both,
depending on which way you want to look at it. Wolf Warrior 2. Number 8, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Sure.
Number 9, Thor Ragnarok. Yep. Number 10, Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
That's global. That's the top 10 movies, all of them, a sequel or a reboot or in some cases both. So how did it become, what changed in the industry that made this the predominant model rather than just like something that Disney might do every once in a while?
There's a couple of arguments. The first argument is that it is more appealing to a studio to produce an existing property, a new version or a sequel to something that people already know because it's easier to sell. There's less resistance on every level. It's a thing. If you already know the thing, you're more likely to be interested in the thing. The other argument is that the mid-range movie has disappeared, which is where you used to see many more original concepts. And they're either turning up on Netflix now, like new films from Nicole Holofcener and Tamara Jenkins, or...
what is a mid-range movie?
It would have been made for somewhere between... It used to be 20 to 60 million. Now it's 5 to 20. It would have been a smallish film, usually a character study or historical drama that doesn't have battle scenes, is about people in rooms or people in, you know, houses having lives and doing things that don't involve capes or murder. And the mid-range movie, even those have mutated into stuff like Bird Box, this Netflix film, which is a post-apocalyptic thing with Sandra Bullock walking through a forest blindfolded. Arrival would have been a mid-range movie, actually. Same screenwriter, Eric Heiser. Arrival would have been a mid-range movie, but instead it was a massive studio awards contender because of what it turned out to be. But I think when they started it out, it was going to be a smaller, more intimate project. So those films don't get made anymore because $20 million into a movie will get you maybe 60 or 80. This is the old thinking. And so now if you make a gargantuan thing that costs $150 million, unless it tanks so spectacularly that, you know, the studio dies, it'll probably pull in $500 million to $1 billion.
Right.
It doesn't have to be good, but it has to be a safer bet.
has to be recognizable.
Exactly. So that's part of it. The Hangover was a tiny little movie that then became a monster franchise because it was a hit, so they made two more.
Am I missing a tooth?
Oh. Whose baby is that?
Check its collar or something.
And in the olden days, they would have stopped after one. They would have just said, oh, that's really cool. This thing made $300 million. Hooray. Everybody likes it.
Let's go to the next original concept.
Let's do another comedy. Exactly. Let's launch something else. When Bradley Cooper was here, like 6 months before, he was here for another original project, a Jim Carrey movie called Yes Man, that tanked. And he said, like, it was insane that Warner was giving this movie to three completely untested, like, Bradley Cooper had never had a hit. Ed Helms had never had a hit. Nobody knew who Zach Galifianakis was outside a couple of comedy cycles, mm-hmm. Or comedy circles and journalists. And they risked that money on this little movie, which couldn't have cost that much. And it was a massive hit. And then they made two more, and they'll probably reboot it in 5 years I would assume women, because that might be interesting. There have been attempts to do a women's version of The Hangover.
Bridesmaids was great.
Rough Night. There's a few of those. The idea of people behaving badly, friend circles getting out of control. They'll reboot The Hangover in 5 years. They'll probably reboot it with women because that's a smart move. Because otherwise you have to – I mean the gender thing really helps because you create a new universe that doesn't depend on the demands of the original film. You can bring – you know, most remakes are very, very rooted in the expectations of the audience.
Right.
Because we all want to be pandered to. We all want to see the thing that we liked again. That's like the governing principle of entertainment now. Give me more of the thing I like.
I understand exactly why the studios do it when you lay it out that way.
Sure.
And the economics in play. Why do we consume it? Why is our bar so low now?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it was always this way.
Well, it probably was. We just didn't know it. The difference is that now instead of knockoffs, which used to happen, you know, if there was a Smokey and the Bandit, there'd be 10 car movies the next year. If there was Rocky, there'd be 5 boxing movies the next year or sports movies.
Yeah.
Or a wave of underdog sports movies is actually what did happen, stuff like Breaking Away and so on. Now we just make more Rockies.
Yeah.
Like we literally
have another one right now.
Creed 2 is Rocky 8 in a way that Creed was not Rocky 7, which is kind of disappointing. And no one can articulate it exactly, but the answer is it's because Creed was the only one that Sylvester Stallone didn't write. And he didn't script it. It was somebody else's project. He was used beautifully in it. But when Ryan Coogler wasn't available to come back to do Creed 2, Stallone jumped in and wrote it, and it's a Rocky movie now. And I think people should be more disappointed by that than they are.
That's the crux of why we want to have this
but they're not.
Conversation, because they're not. And I made fun of when you said at the beginning of this podcast that there would be another Harry Potter and who would be cast as another Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I will watch that Harry Potter movie, or it'll probably actually be a TV show so that they can do it proper justice over 8 years and 8 seasons and whatever it takes.
Oh my God, you could go to school with them in real time. Oh,
yeah.
That's a horrible idea.
But I would watch. So I agree that it's a bad idea, but I will consume that content.
Yeah.
Why?
It's because you want to see your idea of what it should be validated. And in the end, we find out that it doesn't matter if it isn't, because nobody can imagine. Like, everybody's complaining about what a movie isn't and what it shouldn't be. I mean, that's my job, is to say, actually, this. But I hope that I'm coming at it from a perspective of history and a sense of, you know, why you can make this movie, why this movie fails or why this movie succeeds and how this argument could be applied to other movies in similar genres. I'm there to provide context for why you did or didn't like something, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the reboot thing goes, again, it's safer because the curiosity factor has eclipsed everything else. People want to know. They want to see what the new Superman looks like. They want to know what the new Joker, like Joaquin Phoenix is the Joker, but Jared Leto is the Joker. Well, that's
actually
what happens.
Heath Ledger.
Yeah,
the Joker.
So Cesar Romero is the Joker,
Jack
Nicholson is the Joker. That's the point, right? Like, my engagement with this stuff is always, oh, that's interesting, or yeah, I've seen that. There's like, it's a binary. There's no middle ground. There's no mildly successful remake. It either works or it doesn't. And it's because we know what it's supposed to look like. It's because we've been trained by our own lives to want this thing the way it was.
But aren't we supposed to want to watch new stuff?
Oh God, yes. That's all I want. I crave it. Please give me some. But
why would so many people prefer to watch a sequel to something that they already know?
Part of it is that you don't have to invest as much. You already have the backstory. You don't need to introduce new things. Or if you do, you have to do it in a certain way that makes it feel comfortable. Spider-Man Homecoming is an excellent example of that. They turned it into an 80s movie, which makes it simultaneously nostalgic and new in a way that this character doesn't need to be. But it works. It's comforting. And you feel the youth of the characters because he's never been a kid before. Spider-Man's been in high school before in the movies, but he's a child in Tom Holland's performance. He, I mean, the actor is in his 20s, but he looks like a kid, and you can root for him that way. And it makes it feel new, and by having Tony Stark introduce him to the Marvel Universe in Civil War, it was like extending a hand to the franchise and bringing it on. And the fact that I know all of this is nuts, because it's a 2-hour movie, and I shouldn't bring all of this stuff with me to this film, but it's not a reboot. It is the, 18th chapter in a series of films that's been going on for a decade.
Yeah, it's part of a huge thing.
Where we are now culturally, right? It's not just social media and the internet, although that's a huge part of it. It's part of the, it builds expectation. But it's also the fact that this story has been ongoing. And if you missed one, you can probably catch up. It's not a big deal unless you missed an Avengers or a Captain America movie where all the characters are together. You can dip in and out. But if you've been following it all along, it feels really good to know all this stuff. It feels like you're being accommodated in a way that a remake or a sequel or a franchise is supposed to do. It doesn't bar new entry, but it rewards ongoing participation. The Harry Potter films did the same thing. I mean, they made one of those a year for 8 years, right? Or they started to stagger them apart after a while. Once it got too complicated, they were releasing them every year and a half.
Yeah, I don't remember, but I do remember that I saw all of them, even though I didn't really like all of them.
Yeah,
I
did they like didn't the get good until the third one. And we're at a place now culturally where you can say that about a television show. Well, you have to watch the first 6 episodes. No, you don't. You actually don't. But if you don't, you'll miss it. And if everybody's talking about it, then you want to see it. And if it's a thing that everybody talked about 20 years ago, that little tug is still there. So when Fuller House comes back, which is, okay, comfort food at best, right? It's a remake. It's a new season of a show that people grew
it's
up
another
watching.
Show that they've brought back, which is like there's a list of them.
Fine. Yeah. Fuller House is, for me, it's the best example because it's one of those things where when you hear about it, it sounds insane. Why would anyone care? And then you find out exactly how many people do care, which is why it exists. And whether they really want to see it or they're just kind of curious about it, that doesn't matter. As long as they click on it for Netflix, then Netflix has made it worth their while. And we're going to get more of it and we're going to get more of it. And that spurs the need to make more things come back. So there's a new Charmed and there's a new, not on Netflix, but it's all part of the culture. If you can reboot a TV show, you can make millions of dollars right off the bat.
And The Handmaid's Tale just got a built-in audience through its TV show success, and now there's a book sequel.
Margaret Atwood is writing a Handmaid's Tale sequel, which is one of the few things that I'm genuinely interested in because she won't be basing it on the TV series. That's the important part. It will still be set in her world. I mean, I don't need the answers to what happens in The Handmaid's Tale. It's all in the first book. We know what we need to know about that
world.
The
first book was a finished work.
Yeah,
and you know it is because it's been taught in schools for 30 years.
Sure, it's a self-contained narrative.
And if there was one artist in Canada that didn't need to follow the two reasons for producing sequels and remakes that you've just outlined, theoretically it should be Margaret Atwood. She can do whatever she wants.
She absolutely can. But I can also
see... Testament.
I can see the Testament emerging, though, as a response to the show. But that's me understanding the pull of the remake. I would rather just think about it myself than have to watch it executed because the odds are it won't be the thing that I wanted it to be. When Beauty and the Beast, the stage version, came to Toronto, I got to go to a preview, and nobody had told us that the thing was 3 hours long, that it was a massive reconstruction of an 82-minute movie. And when the first deviation came, which is a slightly longer dialogue scene between Belle and her father, there was a child, a very young child, up in the mezzanine who started saying, no, 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 this isn't it, and had to be shushed. And it's like, that's the brain. That's everybody in these things. You really only want to see the thing you like, and you want more of it, but you don't. The kid didn't.
You just wanted Beauty and the Beast.
Being given this opportunity, this child who... I mean, it was after The Lion King, right? So it was the mid to late 90s. And this child who'd only been raised on this movie that was only, at most 10 years old.
Yeah, he didn't want more.
No,
he just wanted the same thing.
And that's all of us, but we won't admit it. So we're still curious. We kind of want to go see what the new thing is, if it's the old thing. And if it's not the old thing, we want to know how we can be comforted by whatever it is that we loved about the old thing. And it never occurs to people to just pull out the old thing and watch it again because those are everywhere. And that's my objection. And yet when a Pete's Dragon comes out or when the Paddington movies come out and they are beautiful, perfect realizations of the spirit of the project, even though they are not the original thing, then you do reconnect with the thing you loved about it. And I think it's also very telling that those are projects for children.
Yeah, we're all children now.
We want to be, right? Like, isn't that the whole thing? the lie of the governed is that you want a strong, like, what's mm-hmm. the argument? The Republicans are the strong father and the Democrats are the nurturing mother, and you can only have one at a time. But we see what a strong father looks like, and it's horrible, and we retreat, and we want whatever comforts us.
Thanks, Norm.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Norm Willner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and the host of a great podcast called Someone Else's Movie. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. And for more from us, including zero remakes of our past episodes, you can visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also find us on social media at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And of course, we are wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, tell a friend. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.